What I want to do this evening is really give an introductory talk to the whole authorship issue. Instead of just giving a whole list of facts and saying this is why the Stratford man can't have been the author, this is why the Earl of Oxford was, I want to take a broader, more philosophical approach and put Shakespeare in his cultural and historical context and show you from that that William Shakespeare of Stratford, the part-time actor and entrepreneur, could not have been the author William Shakespeare. I want to start by going back to the United States and telling you a bit about how this subject is developing, and perhaps to answer the question that is so often asked of me, which is why now? Why is this issue being resolved now? And it really is. There's an enormous movement in the States now, and I'm hoping that this will also move to England. I think the answer to that is basically of a political nature. Our society now in many ways reflects certain of the issues in Elizabethan society at the time, and it's an age in which Shakespeare is vitally important to us. It's important to understand who he really was, because if you look at Shakespeare's plays, the big philosophical dynamic in them, in every single play, is the conflict between capitalism and feudalism. And at the end of the 20th century now, where capitalism rages unchecked, if you like, it seems to be the only standard in our society, is capitalist exchange at the expense of any sort of spiritual exchange between individuals. Shakespeare is particularly important to us. And I think now we, with the new age emerging, we're now at a turning point whereby people are reassessing our values in society. And of course, the flame of capitalism burnt brightest, really, or has burnt brightest in the last 10 years. And I think that that's beginning to fade. We're emerging towards a society which will be more neo-feudal in its outlook, and which, in fact, I believe Shakespeare predicted in his plays. So it's vitally important for us to not only understand what Shakespeare's real message is, because he was not all things to all men, as the scholars tell us. He was an individual human being. You know, he was brilliant, but he was also prejudiced. He was born in a particular section of society, and that shaped his views and his philosophy of life. And we don't do him any favours, and we don't honour him, if we don't attempt to get to the bottom of what his message really is. And his message is vitally important to us today. That is why the authorship question is a big issue. During the course of this talk, I will just expand a bit more on those parallels that I see between Elizabethan society then and our society today. But we do have that conflict in society today. You can see it in the environmental movement, in people's desire for more local politics and for a greater sense of community in our society, rather than having a society in which each human being is merely a political statistic and an economic unit. And in which you get these giant centralized governments, you get the nightmare of bureaucracy in Europe, and so on. So again, I think Edward de Vere as Shakespeare can be a guiding figure to us in the 21st century. Now, of course, one of the worst things at the end of this 20th century has been political correctness, which is almost a disease. And nowhere does it rage more than in our universities. And now, having spoken at so many colleges across the United States, I have met with this phenomenon firsthand, and it's a pretty ugly monster, I must tell you. But that again, I believe, is in its decline. And I am very heartened in my tours of campuses around the States to see people beginning to be more open-minded about this issue. Of course, before the Second World War, scholars in this country and the world over were amateurs. They did the subject for the love of it. All the great Shakespearean scholars, like Malone, Chambers, they were amateurs. They were either civil servants, they were lawyers. They worked on Shakespeare for the love of it. Now you have a whole professional body of scholars who speak their own language. They're not interested in communicating with the public outside. They just communicate with other scholars. And their language is utter gibberish. And in fact, there was a very interesting article in Times Literary Supplement, I think it was about a year ago, in which the author, an academic himself, described it thus. He said, watching an academic write is like seeing Tweedledee and Tweedledum fight. Remember, they cover themselves in mattresses, blankets, and so on. So the object of fighting becomes completely destroyed because they're too well defended. and no academic today will make a positive statement without negating it in the next sentence. That is part of the curse of political correctness. And that extends to the whole idea of De Vere as the author, because I've met with scholars and debated with scholars in the States who cannot provide any evidence to me that the Earl of Oxford was not the author, that the Stratford man was. And in the end, they in effect say, well, De Vere may have been the author, but he oughtn't to have been, i.e. he is a politically incorrect author. And I sometimes wake up in the middle of the night, and it's my worst nightmare, and think, well, suppose we did get the smoking gun, the one piece of hard evidence to demonstrate that Edward De Vere was Shakespeare. Would the scholars even accept that? That's it's a very disturbing thought. But anyway, enough of the preamble. I've now spoken in a lot of prep schools and high schools. This is the next generation of university students. These people are taking on this idea. Many prep schools in the States now teach De Vere as Shakespeare. And it's been very rewarding returning to schools and actually now having this as part of the curriculum. So the next generation of university students, certainly in the United States, are going to be asking very pertinent questions of their professors about this subject. Now, throughout this talk, I will refer to the Stratford man, the traditional Shakespeare, as William Shakespeare. That's how he referred to himself. That's how he signed his name in the only writings we have of his, which are six signatures. And I will refer to the author as William Shakespeare, which is the name that appeared on the title pages of the quarto editions of Shakespeare's works. The name Shakespeare never appeared on those quartos, and in fact, in about 50% of the cases, the name was hyphenated, Shake-Spear, clearly denoting a pen name and the action of shaking a spear. So I will maintain that distinction. What I want to do immediately is go to the contradiction at the heart of this whole authorship question, the issue which has drawn so many people in. And that is this. It's the contradiction between, on the one hand, William Shakespeare of Stratford, what we know about him, we know a great deal about his biography, and on the other hand, the author himself, as he reveals himself to us in this enormous body of work. It's no coincidence that a great number of creative writers have been interested in who Shakespeare was, because they are familiar with the whole process of writing, the whole process of converting the base metal of your life experiences into the gold of art. They know what's involved, and they know that every work of fiction is highly autobiographical. You cannot divorce an author from his artistic creation. In fact, if you look at American writers, it's almost a who's who of American writers, those who have denied the Stratford man's authorship. Mark Twain, Henry James, Walt Whitman, Ralph Waldo Emerson, John Greenleaf Whittier, then many great figures in the 20th century like Sigmund Freud were not only anti-Stratfordians but actually Oxfordians as well. And I would like to take the words of Emerson, who said with regard to Shakespeare, "I cannot marry the man to the verse," i.e. there is this irreconcilable contradiction between Shakespeare and Shakespeare. These men are the complete antithesis of each other. And I briefly want to explore two areas in which this contradiction is most manifest. The first, of course, is education. No one would deny that Shakespeare is the most brilliantly erudite man of his age. Here is a man with a knowledge of the classics, a knowledge of French, Italian, and also Spanish, a man that makes use of Greek and Italian works which had not been translated into either English or Latin during his lifetime. He uses them firsthand. Here is a man who has a knowledge of the law, of music, botany, cosmography, political science, heraldry, all the disciplines of the time in which the nobility were schooled. And, of course, here is a man who portrays the world of the nobility in his works in a way in which cannot be faked. Look, for instance, at his knowledge of the aristocratic sports, of falconry, hunting, bowls and tennis. There were no public bowling alleys, no public tennis courts in England in Elizabethan times. They were affixed to the big private houses. Shakespeare draws these images naturally. He'd clearly taken part in these sports. They were favourite sports from an early age. There were no encyclopedias in the Elizabethan age. Shakespeare couldn't go up and say, right, I want to draw an image from falconry. Let's look up some technical terms. And he draws these terms when he's describing completely different things. He doesn't have to be in the falconry field, to describe falconry, you can describe the feelings of two lovers between each other, a wrangle between two lawyers, and he immediately draws this image. It's part of his metaphorical system of thought. Ben Jonson, on the other hand, is very different. Ben Jonson was a bookworm, and of course, his learning is very much laid on thickly, and is manufactured. But Shakespeare is not so. So you have this incredibly erudite man drawing from this wide range of disciplines. Now, what do we have as far as the Stratford man is concerned? We have a man who was born to illiterate parents, whose two surviving children grew up illiterate, and who, as far as the records tell us, this is a man, Shakespeare, incidentally, who used 20,000 different words in his works, 2.5 times that of John Milton, another great wordsmith. And yet, in his incorporation, in his incarnation as the Stratford man, he only uses 11 letters of the alphabet during his life, and even those incompetently. You can see what Emerson means about the contradiction. So you have a man not only who had no education, as far as we can tell, but who was never part of any cultural group whatsoever. No writer of the time between 1564 and 1616 ever puts on record that he knew Shakespeare. No philosopher, no artist, no cultural figure whatsoever. Only Ben Jonson, posthumously, in 1623, 7 years after the Stratford man's death, in very ambiguous language, says that he knew Shakespeare. But even then, he doesn't tie him down to Stratford upon Avon at all. So there is no record whatsoever, either that this man was an intellectual figure, that he was a writer, or even, believe it or not, that he was an actor. There is only one record of Shakespeare performing in a play, and this is contradicted by another record of the same performance 3 months later, which suggests that the entry is supposititious and was entered afterwards. So, again, we have that, and in contrast to that, Edward de Vere, the 17th Earl of Oxford, who matriculated at Cambridge University at the age of 8, was a child prodigy, had the finest tutors in the land, and whose tutor, Lawrence Noel, Dean of Lichfield, said at the age of 13, he said about him, "I can teach him no more," and asked to be relieved of his duties as a tutor. So de Vere was part of this cultural environment. He had many of the great writers, nearly all the great writers of the day, under his wing. He was the greatest literary patron of the day. More literary works are dedicated to him than any other figure of the time, excepting Queen Elizabeth. Now, the other area in which the contradiction is most manifest, and I've touched on this, is the whole court environment. Shakespeare is clearly, as Enoch Powell has pointed out, the court dramatist of the time. 36 of the 37 plays of Shakespeare are set in royal or noble courts. This is his world. Shakespeare is interested in knowing how the nobility think and feel. In fact, his protagonists are always from the court, his fully rounded figures. It is men from the Stratford man's background that are stereotyped. They're given silly names: Dogberry, Verges, Bottom, Bullcalf, Wart. They are brought on the stage as the butt of the nobility, to be mocked. These are not Shakespeare's fully rounded characters. He stereotypes them, and that is true to life. If we meet someone from a background different from ours, immediately there's fear, there's prejudice, we stereotype them. If we meet someone from the same background, we tend to look at them immediately as individuals. Shakespeare looks at the courtiers as individuals. And remember, the royal court of Queen Elizabeth was the most exclusive club of the day. It was her private household. You couldn't just walk into the royal court any more than you can today and begin satirizing its figures and describing them in such detail. You had to be part of that particular society. There's no evidence that William Shakespeare Stratford ever spent a single minute of his life in the court. Queen Elizabeth, he was never presented to Queen Elizabeth. He was never presented to King James. There are no court records. No one mentions in their diaries Shakespeare was at court, acting in one of his own plays, or he was presented to one of the monarchs. There is a complete silence. So there, again, we have a very curious fact. How did Shakespeare make the court world his world? Why was he so interested in describing it? And not just describing it. Shakespeare's whole philosophy is from the old feudal nobility. As Walt Whitman pointed out, And no one can accuse Walt Whitman of being a snob. He's called the poet of democracy. He claimed that Shakespeare's plays were undemocratic, and he said of them that Shakespeare's history plays were conceived out of the fullest heat and pulse of feudalism by one of the wolfish earls who are so plenteous in the plays. And what Whitman meant by that is that, well, if I had to describe Shakespeare's plays in one sentence, I would describe them as the death cry of feudalism, the death cry of the old feudal world. And Shakespeare describes the journey of the feudal soul better than anyone I know. If you take an early character like Barone, trace him through Romeo to Hamlet and right through to King Lear, you see the way in which someone brought up in the feudal nobility reacts with this new Renaissance society into which he is born. And that whole dynamic between the emerging capitalist society and the old feudal society informs Shakespeare's plays completely. And Oxford was from one of these very families. In fact, Oxford was this extraordinary combination of, on the one hand, feudal aristocrat, and on the other hand, bohemian. He was an artist. He had no time for the sycophancies of court life and the court reptilia. Here was a man who enjoyed the company of actors and playwrights because these were people who were not pretentious. They told the truth, and no one told the truth more fully than Shakespeare. So he's this very explosive combination of bohemian and aristocrat, rather like Lord Byron. Take Shakespeare, and he is Byron magnified 1,000 times. In fact, there are many, many similarities between their two lives. He is not a grain merchant from Stratford-upon-Avon. Please take my word for that. Now, having said that, I also want to point out very quickly that, of course, Shakespeare's attitude to women is very enlightened. He treats women as the equals of men. And if you look at a play like Much Ado and you look at the banter between Beatrice and Benedick in that play, you will see that Beatrice often wins the jousting, verbal jousts that they have and so on. This was an enlightened view that really only held at court at that time. In the Stratford man's background at that time, women were considered inferiors and chattels. So again, Shakespeare presents women from an aristocratic viewpoint. Finally, I would just like to mention the fact that, as everyone knows, many of Shakespeare's plays are set on the continent, particularly in Italy. Now, Edward de Vere spent 16 months travelling on the continent, and particularly in Italy, and visited all those towns in northern Italy, like Venice, Padua, and Mantua, in which Shakespeare's various Italian plays are set. Now, he's not just taking an Italian setting. Many Italian writers and scholars have said that no one evokes their country better than Shakespeare. He shows a detailed knowledge of Renaissance culture in Italy, of the various laws governing the city of Venice. Now, there wasn't a Baedeker guide to Venice in Elizabethan times. You had to have been there. Again, like the knowledge of falconry, like the knowledge of the court, it's not something you can manufacture out of thin air. Remember, there's a difference between imagination and fantasy. And so these Italian plays are very damning for the Stratfordians. William Shakespeare of Stratford never left the shores of his native England. And of course, if you look at a play like The Merchant of Venice, Shakespeare shows a knowledge of precise topographical details in that city. And there is evidence that, in fact, de Vere had his own villa in Venice, that he liked it there so much. So again, what we have here is this contradiction between Shakespeare and Shakespeare, and they are irreconcilable. And when I present these contradictions to professors across the United States, there's only one answer to my point, and that is genius. They say, well, Shakespeare was a transcendent genius. He didn't need teachers, he didn't need to go to school, he could intuit knowledge. And I haven't sufficiently understood the workings of genius. Well, I've read quite a few books on geniuses, Mozart for one, and I know perfectly well that these people work enormously hard. Mozart, born into an extremely musical family, his father Leopold was not only a court musician but a composer, started teaching his son from the age of three. Mozart was schooled in all the different styles. We have Mozart's letters to other musicians and other composers as well, in a way that we have not a single letter from Shakespeare to anyone. This most literary man, the most literary man that ever lived, we have not a single letter. And incidentally, this aversion to letter writing is not one shared by the true author. because there are many letters written out in full in Shakespeare's plays. So, you have this extraordinary situation then. Genius cannot flourish in a vacuum. If Mozart had been born to parents, say, who were weavers in the north of Scotland, and there wasn't a piano in the house, of course, he would never have known the piano. He would have never known the world of music. Genius needs the environment in which to flourish. And of course, there's never been such a thing as a literary prodigy, in the sense of a child prodigy. In order to write, you need experience of life, you need to have conversed with your fellow men, to have thought and to have read. So again, this argument of genius simply does not hold up. And Sigmund Freud said about this very subject that genius should never be placed above examination. Genius should only be used as an explanation when all other solutions have failed. Well, there's a much better solution than genius. Of course, whoever Shakespeare was a genius. But he was a genius that worked in a very specific cultural, social, and political environment. Now, the other extraordinary thing about the authorship issue, which I touched upon, is the silence surrounding this man, the mysterious silence. Here is a writer who reflects his own age and the changes in his society more fully and better than anyone does in the Elizabethan age. And yet this man is completely anonymous to his age. There is not a single anecdote of the time about Shakespeare. No one says, "I met Shakespeare last night at the pub, I had a drink with him. I saw him acting in one of his own plays. I saw him being presented at court." But Elizabethan England was the first age which was really well documented. There were diarists, note-takers, observers of society, all noting down the gossip and scandal in London. John Chamberlain, a great letter writer, lives in the theatre district in London, in Silver Street. And yet, Chamberlain, in all his letters, and he goes to all the plays, he mentions the playwrights, he never mentions a William Shakespeare. Shakespeare is absent from the diaries of the theatrical people of the time. Philip Henslowe keeps a logbook from 1590 to 1609, the very years of Shakespeare's so-called writing career. Does Henslowe ever mention Shakespeare? Never. He puts on Shakespeare's plays, but Shakespeare never signs for payment. So when the Stratfordians tell you that Shakespeare wrote for money, isn't it curious that he never received a single payment for any of the plays he wrote? Of course, if he was an aristocrat, he simply could not receive payment for those plays. So Shakespeare then is Mr. No Man in London. He's absent from the records of the time. Although he's described by Ben Jonson as the soul of the age, he's simply not worthy of comment. Now, of course, the only way I can explain that is by positing that this man had to keep his identity concealed for some reason. A, William Shakespeare was not his real name, it was a pen name, just as Mark Twain is a pen name for Samuel Clemens. And B, that for political reasons, this man had to hide his identity. He could not be known for who he was. And indeed, if we just trust what Shakespeare tells us, we see very early on that he tells us exactly this. Now, you can argue whether the plays are autobiographical. I believe they very firmly are. But one thing you can't argue about is whether the sonnets are autobiographical or not. These are the only works of Shakespeare we have in which he uses the first person singular, that magic authorial word, I. And in the sonnets, Shakespeare tells us very clearly that he writes under a pen name. When the sonnets first appeared in 1609, the name William Shakespeare was on the title page, hyphenated William Shakespeare, and it was on the running heads of all the different pages. Now, this edition of the sonnets in 1609 was considered so controversial that the Star Chamber ordered all copies of the sonnets in and had them destroyed. I believe only 12 copies survive today. But the important point here is that in sonnet 76, Shakespeare writes, "Why write I, still all one, ever the same, and keep invention in a noted weed, that every word doth almost tell my name, showing their birth and where they did proceed." Now that line is fatuous, almost meaningless, if his name is on the title page and the running heads. Every word doth almost tell my name. But that line gains energy and meaning if you posit an author whose identity was being concealed for political reasons, as Edward de Vere's was, and a man who could not be known as this great author and could not be recognized for his achievement. And of course, the Elizabethans were addicted to wordplay of every kind, especially punning on their names. We might find it futile and childish today, But, you know, if you look at the way that John Donne puns on his own name, it becomes tedious after a while. But you must remember, it was part of Renaissance literature to encode yourself in your works, because they saw no separation between an author and his works. And Shakespeare, or Edward de Vere, is always punning on his name, Edward de Vere, or E. Vere. And of course, every word doth almost tell my name. Every word is an anagram of A. Ward Vere. You just have to change one word and you get one letter and you get Edward Vere. Every word doth almost tell my name, showing their birth and where they did proceed. And throughout the plays, you have the pun on the name Vere and De Vere. And of course, Vere means truth. And this was an author who set himself to tell the truth about Queen Elizabeth and her court. And that is why Shakespeare was so controversial, because he dishes the dirt on Queen Elizabeth. He was the one person, he took to heart Castiglione's lesson that the true courtier should not flatter their monarch, but should always tell the truth. And that's why he always presents himself as the court jester in the plays, the person who, by pretending to be mad or being mad, is allowed to tell the truth. Hamlet is another one. There is no jester in the play of Hamlet, because Hamlet plays that role. He has to pretend to be mad in order to tell the truth. Now, it would be very unusual if an author, the greatest author ever, who is not to be recognized for his writings, should not feel enormous pain and grief at that, and should not express that pain in his writings. And of course, the sonnets are very moving to me, because Shakespeare again and again expresses this paradox, that on the one hand, his own works will live forever, but on the other, he will die to the world. This is a paradox which is inexplicable in terms of the Stratford man, because we hear the name William Shakespeare every day. But in sonnet after sonnet, in sonnet 81, in addressing the fair youth, probably the Earl of Southampton, Shakespeare writes, "Or I shall live your epitaph to make, or you survive when I in earth am rotten. Your name from hence immortal life shall have, though I once gone to all the world must die." Now, "I once gone to all the world must die." Simply not true, as far as the Stratford man goes. But very poignant about Edward de Vere, a man who was consigned to historical oblivion by the power brokers of his age. And he did die in 1604 to the world, and was not rediscovered till 1920, when Thomas Loney published his pioneering work, Shakespeare Identified, in the 17th Earl of Oxford. So that line suddenly jumps out at you and becomes very meaningful. And again, in the sonnets, he expresses the aristocratic attitude towards literature. In sonnet 72, he says, "My name be buried where my body is, and live no more to shame nor me nor you, for I am shamed by that which I bring forth, and so should you, to love things nothing worth." Now that was the attitude of the aristocracy towards literature. You could not be professionally or commercially involved in literature. You could write the odd sonnet on a rainy afternoon, you could write several, bind them up and circulate them among your friends. And indeed, Francis Mears tells us that this is what Shakespeare did. He refers to his sugared sonnets among his private friends. But that's not the way William Shakespeare from Stratford, the businessman, would have operated. He would have operated in a commercial way. He would have had no shame in writing about the plays. But for the Earl of Oxford, it's very important to understand it was a continual source of shame that he was giving up his whole life to literature, that he was, in a sense, a professional hack. And he would have lost caste, and he did lose caste, among his fellows for so doing. Indeed, Lord Burghley, his father-in-law, continually upbraids him for mixing with actors and writers, his lewd friends, as he calls them. So it's important to understand that dynamic in Elizabethan society, the censorship involved in the theatre. The theatre was considered for reprobates. The theatres were in the red light districts in London. It would be unthinkable for the ranking earl of the realm to be known to be writing plays for the public theatre, and to be seen in the theatre district, perhaps even rehearsing his own players, because the Earl of Oxford had two acting companies under his patronage for most of his lifetime. And it's interesting that he actually used to rehearse his own players at the Boar's Head Tavern in Eastcheap. That's where the Earl of Oxford players rehearsed. And of course, that's the very tavern in which Falstaff and Prince Hull hold their various revels. So that's important to recognize then, this whole taboo about the nobility being involved commercially or professionally in literature. But Edward de Vere was very far-sighted. And in fact, when in 1578, Gabriel Harvey, who was the professor of civil law at Cambridge, professor of rhetoric, sorry, at Cambridge, made an address to Oxford in front of the Queen. He said to him, it is disgraceful for someone of your station to be dedicating yourself professionally to literature. Put down the pen and take up the sword. That's what an old feudal aristocrat should be doing. He should have a sword in his hand, not a pen. The Earl of Oxford responded by redesigning his family crest, which shows a lion holding up a bleeding paw. And he redesigned it and he put a spear in the lion's paw. The lion is now shaking a spear, and the spear is broken, and out of the end comes a quill or a pen. So Shakespeare, or Edward de Vere, is saying directly to Gabriel Harvey, no, my pen is my sword, and no one can deny that. Here is a man who wrote Henry V, which has had an impact on the English sense of patriotism ever since it was written, and has helped defend his country over the centuries. So Shakespeare, or Edward de Vere, really did defend his country through his pen. And be under no illusions the grief that this would cause to a man who was born and brought up to be a warrior. But remember, we're in a society now in which the old feudal aristocracy is being disbanded finally. Henry VII, Elizabeth's grandfather, had started the process. Henry VIII, her father, had carried it on. And she, under her Machiavellian chief minister, William Cecil, Lord Burghley, completed the process and disbanded the great feudal nobility. She had the Duke of Norfolk executed on trumped-up charges. Norfolk, of course, was one of the most powerful aristocrats of the time. He ruled a 600-square-mile section of land known as the Liberty of Norfolk, in which his laws prevailed over the laws of England. And these were the people that new centralized government of the time were determined to extirpate. And of course, Oxford's emotional ties were to the old feudal nobility. He was a first cousin of Thomas Howard, the Duke of Norfolk, through his uncle, the Earl of Surrey, who was, of course, another great writer of the time, who incidentally was introduced blank verse into the English language, which Shakespeare then made his own. So that was the Earl of Oxford's uncle. So you have this incredible tension within Shakespeare, between, on the one hand, the man who is committed to this old world, which he knows is dying, but who wants to take the best from it and take it into the new world. Because every great writer, whether it's Proust or Tolstoy, is reactionary in an emotional and political sense. They tend to look at the past as something that must be treasured, and they are priests of the past, and they take from the past and bring over certain things to the present. And Shakespeare brought over what was best from feudalism, the sense of community, the strong helping the weak, a sense of cohesiveness in which every man has a role in society, and not the sort of dog-eats-dog society which William Cecil was introducing and the new political bureaucracy and political nobility of Elizabeth was introducing. So it's important to understand that dynamic, this great battle between William Cecil, Lord Burghley, who became Oxford's father-in-law. Oxford married his daughter Anne Cecil. This battle between him on the one hand and the Earl of Oxford, because that was a battle of worlds, and these two worlds clash continually in the plays. And, of course, to our delight, de Vere managed to portray William Cecil in many of the plays, and no more more fully than in Polonius in Hamlet, one of the greatest portrayals of the new political men in Elizabethan society. And if political correctness, the language of political correctness, began anywhere, it began with Polonius. His deviousness of mind, his inability to communicate with other people directly, is reflected marvelously in his language, in which he keeps interrupting himself. He veers off here, veers off there. This is the new politician. This is the type of leader we are to have from now on, Shakespeare is saying, and this is the type of leader which will be very disastrous to this country. So anyway, that's the dynamic, political dynamic within the plays. And I want to say one last thing before I move on to my final point, which is the political one about satire in the plays, and that is this. That whole change in society is reflected in Shakespeare's vocabulary. Have you ever asked yourself why Shakespeare and not anyone else has such a large vocabulary? Well, I think the answer is fairly obvious in terms of Edward de Vere's authorship, and that is this. Because society was moving on, you got a disenfranchised group of the old nobility, like Edward de Vere, like the Duke of Norfolk, like the Duke of Northumberland, who were no longer able to act in the role of feudal aristocrat and have their own baronies and rule their own courts, but who had to come to London and pay attention to the Queen, but whose interest then turned towards the arts. Here was a class of people that had to redefine itself in order to survive, and many of them turned to the arts and became important writers or scientists or what have you. And Edward de Vere was chief among these. And that's why his vocabulary is so enormous, because he was completely redefining his world and the world of these other men coming with him. Because, of course, you only have as large a vocabulary as you need. If I'm a North Sea fisherman on the North Sea of Scotland, I have a certain professional vocabulary to carry out my work, and then I have a social vocabulary when I have a pint with my friends in the evening. Nothing more. I'm not going to be exploring the ins and outs of the English language. And of course, in Stratford-upon-Avon, a small market town, 4 days' ride from London, where there was one little grammar school, no private libraries in the country at the time, they were not exploring language. The court of Queen Elizabeth was where all the exploration into linguistics was occurring and where English was being redefined, because the language in those days was always redefined by the people at the top, the power brokers. And, of course, this is why Shakespeare has this enormous vocabulary. And I think that's one of the most damning things about the Stratford man's claim to authorship, is that he would not have had this vocabulary. And, indeed, he was born speaking a Warwickshire dialect which would have been unintelligible to most people in London. We know that men coming into London at the time of the Armada to be drafted into the army from the provinces had to have interpreters with them to make themselves understood in the capital. There is not a single word of specifically Warwickshire dialect in any of the plays. Are we expected to believe that a man who arrived in London at the age of 26 suddenly forgot the language in which he was brought up? I very much doubt it. Finally then, the crux of the whole Shakespeare problem. It's the political issue. Shakespeare has been kept under the equivalent of the Official Secrets Act in this country for 400 years because he told the true story of Queen Elizabeth and the royal court. He could not be known for who he was. The plays of Shakespeare are social and political dynamite. In play after play, he satirizes not only Queen Elizabeth, but all her cronies, the Earl of Leicester, Sir Philip Sidney, Sir Christopher Hatton, William Cecil, and Robert Cecil. And remember, the Elizabethan age was an age of great censorship. You could not criticize the government openly. There was no opposition party. This was an autocracy that would make somewhere like Soviet Russia look very tame indeed. So you must remember the political conditions. And if you had a writer who was trying to criticize the government, he needed three things. He needed to know the people intimately he was criticizing. He needed royal protection to have his head remaining on his shoulders. And he needed enormous daring. Edward de Vere possessed all those three qualities. There's no evidence that William Shakespeare possessed a single one. So let me briefly deal with this issue. If the Earl of Oxford had his name on the plays, then the veil would be rent. And suddenly people would see that Polonius in Hamlet is William Cecil, that Gertrude is Queen Elizabeth, the court of Elsinore is the court at Windsor, that Hamlet is the Earl of Oxford. And all these characters come alive, that Claudius is the Earl of Leicester, and so on. And these portraits become real. Horatio is Horatio Vere, Oxford's best friend and cousin. If, on the other hand, the political power brokers of the day, who wanted to preserve Shakespeare's achievement, but not his identity, if they could foist the works upon someone else, someone completely unconnected with the court, namely William Shakespeare, then the plays become depoliticized, and that's how they're taught in our schools today. Then suddenly, they can't be about the royal court. Shakespeare's just taking these old stories, like Hamlet, Lear, and so on, and just dressing them up. But you see, the reason Edward de Vere didn't choose a single original plot for his plays was political protection. So that if he was hauled up in front of the Privy Council and they said, you are satirizing the Queen as Gertrude, which is a capital offence, he could have said, no, no, I'm just telling the old story of Hamlet. You'll find it in all the chronicles. So that's the thing here. If William Shakespeare is the author of the Shakespeare plays, then they are no longer political satires of court life. And of course, Shakespeare had no access to the court of Elizabeth. He lived 4 days' ride from London for nearly all his life. And therefore, he's a safe bet. Even better, he's working in the theatre world of London as an entrepreneur. So people know the name Shakespeare, Shakespeare. So people remember, oh yes, there was someone there working in the theatre. And even better, masterful the Elizabethans were, he is illiterate. So he can leave no trace of literary efforts behind him, which would be clearly inferior to Shakespeare's. So there are no letters, so of course, which would definitely demonstrate that he couldn't have been Shakespeare. There's nothing to foul it, just those six signatures, embarrassing in themselves, but not actually fatal, because we're told that he wrote them when he was ill. So we have an interesting dynamic here, and it's a political one, and this issue is political. If we take, for instance, a play like Hamlet, we will see that it is the greatest exposé of court life under Elizabeth that you can imagine. And it tells De Vere's story. He is Hamlet. These plays are completely autobiographical. Because what is the story of Hamlet? It's the story of a nobleman, very high up at court, who is sidelined politically. He is disinherited by a scheming uncle. He is sidelined politically. He is an artistic figure anyway who doesn't fit in with the mainstream of court life, and who determines to get his revenge by telling the truth through the theatre. That's the weapon he knows, that's the weapon he's going to use. And remember, there was no media in Elizabethan times. The theatre was the best way of getting your message across politically. And that's exactly what De Vere did. Disenfranchised within the court of Elizabeth, he told his story through the theatre. Now, when the play was first put on in the 1580s at court, if you'd said to any courtier watching the play, "Who is Hamlet?" they would have immediately said De Vere, because here is a man in Hamlet who is not only a patron of actors, as De Vere was, he's also a writer, as De Vere was. Hamlet inserts the speech into the play of The Mousetrap. But he's also an actor, a consummate actor, as De Vere was. Feuerer, a Stratfordian scholar, describes Edward De Vere as the greatest comic actor of his time. And fourthly, he's a director. Hamlet directs the players, just as I believe that Edward de Vere directed his own acting companies. There were no formal directors in those times. So people would have immediately recognized at court who he was. And it's fine for the courtiers to laugh among themselves at the satire. But it is not fine for that to go outside the exclusive club and for it to be known by the public at large that William Cecil, the most powerful man in England, Elizabeth's chief minister, the Lord Treasurer, is in fact this bumbling Machiavellian bureaucrat, Polonius. That is unacceptable. That is subversive. The government could fall. So you can see the dynamic at work here. As for Queen Elizabeth, the notion that she was the Virgin Queen was one of the best promulgated myths, political myths of the time. Her virginity was, of course, political, not biological. As the court records of the time so clearly tell us, and as the plays tell us. And of course, in Shakespeare, in Edward de Vere, you had an author who could go beyond this political myth constructed by William Cecil and Queen Elizabeth. Now, it was an important political myth, and de Vere recognized that, because as I said before, Elizabeth was completing this process of the centralization of government, and it was very powerful for her to stand up in front of Parliament and point at her coronation ring and say, "This is my wedding ring. I am married to my people. I am married to England." That was a very powerful idea in uniting Englishmen under a single monarch for the very first time in English history. It was wonderful for politics abroad. She could continually hold out the possibility that she might marry a prince from France or Spain. So again, this political virginity was very, very important. Unfortunately, with Shakespeare, with Edward de Vere, she had a man who knew her privately, who had had an affair with her, and probably even a son, who many Oxfordians believe was brought up in the Southampton family as the Earl of Southampton, to whom Shakespeare dedicates his poetical works. And remember, the sonnets, if they're written to the Earl of Southampton, are written to a son. Many times the author of the sonnets uses the image of a father addressing his son, and he says, "Look, I've had experience of life. Don't make the same mistakes that I made when I was your age." It's very much a paternal tone. So anyway, here you have him exploding the myth in the plays of the Virgin Queen. He portrays Elizabeth again and again in the plays as Gertrude in Hamlet, as Cleopatra in Antony and Cleopatra, hardly the Virgin Queen, as Olivia in Twelfth Night. So, again, you've got a very dangerous dynamic. He is undercutting much of the political propaganda of the time. He's saying, this is how it really happened in court. And this, to me, is the crux of the authorship question. It's why it wasn't discussed then. It's why it's not discussed today. Because it is highly inconvenient. A lot of history would have to be rewritten. A lot of our ideas would have to be revised, not only about Shakespeare, but about the whole Elizabethan age. And one of the reasons why this whole issue has lain dormant, why the Stratford ideology has been able to flourish, is because in our universities we build walls between the different departments. No one in the English department will speak to anyone in the history department. And what I'm saying to you is, if you place Shakespeare in his historical context, then he cannot be the Stratford man. If you print that he's growing common. Now, that's not how Elizabethan society worked. If any of these literary scholars knew anything about history, they couldn't claim that for a moment. They're turning society on its head. Similarly, Oxford says in Sonnet 125, "Where it ought to me, I bore the canopy with my extern the outward honouring. The Earls of Oxford bore the canopy over the Queen as Lord Great Chamberlains of England." How on earth can that refer to William Shakespeare of Stratford upon Avon? So we denigrate Shakespeare if we take Shakespeare as the author. I will end up by saying this, as final summation. There are three sorts of evidence that we use in supporting Oxford. I've just given you the broad brushstrokes this evening. What we do is we compare Oxford's existing writing with the mature writings of Shakespeare, and we see that Shakespeare left us no juvenilia, whereas Oxford left us no mature writings. If you put the two together, you get a whole corpus. And Oxford was praised as a writer by other people in the 1580s and 1590s, but we have nothing to show for it. Clearly they were praising him for works which appeared pseudonymously or anonymously. Secondly, we say the plays are autobiographical, and we show that Oxford's life story is told again and again in the plays, the different conflicts of court are shown again and again. And thirdly, we look at Elizabethan society, and especially the literary world of the time, and we see two remarkable facts. If you read the pamphlets of the writers of the time, they state two things. Again and again, they say there is a man going round masquerading as an author that he isn't. Robert Greene calls him the upstart crow. Ben Jonson calls him the poet ape. I know they're referring to William Shakespeare. And side by side with that, they talk of a great giant of literature, a man who is unrecognized. Marston describes him thus in 1599, in referring to Shakespeare. He says, "Far fly thy fame, most of me beloved, whose silent name one letter bounds, Edward de Vere. Thy true judicial style I ever honour, and if my love beguile not much my hopes, then thy unvalued worth shall mount fair place when apes are turned forth." Again and again in the annals of the time you have this sense of a great invisible genius working behind the scenes. I will finally end up with a quote from Ben Jonson, who knew Edward de Vere and he knew Shakespeare. And again in his tribute, his moving tribute to Shakespeare, at the preface of the first folio, at the end of it, he takes cognizance of the badge of the De Veres, the five-pointed star, and he ends his tribute by saying, "But wait, I see thee in the hemisphere advanced and made a constellation there. Shine forth, thou star of poets." Thank you.